And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show for Friday, October 13th. Derek Van Riper here with Stephen Nesbitt. A lot going on in the baseball world. A great first day back for me, Stephen. I'm excited.
Welcome, DVR. We're glad to have you back. I've been sitting in the host seat here on Fridays for a while with Keith Law, but this week we kicked Keith off to Arizona and said, DVR, can you take the reins again?
The Arizona Fall League is wonderful, so I'm looking forward to reading Keith's stuff from there. I know he's got at least one piece up already, so I'll be digging into that shortly, but focusing on the big leagues primarily in this episode because the Philadelphia Phillies have eliminated the Atlanta Braves again in four games, and there was a lot of drama in Game 4. There was a lot of drama leading into Game 4, and I'm glad my first day back on the pod didn't have to cover all of that. I'm grateful for your help while I was gone, but also for Eno and Britt on 3-0 having to discuss the Arcia clubhouse gate. And there's been even more fallout since then. But frankly, I want to focus on the field. And a ton has changed for the Phillies just in the last couple of months. I mean, Nick Castellanos, who was pretty cold at the end of the season, had another two-homer night, back-to-back nights where he did that. No one's ever done that in the postseason before. Trey Turner, now beloved in Philadelphia. Who would have thought? If you go back to May, June, I mean, this was a guy that fans were so frustrated with because Phillies gave him a big bucket of money and it wasn't happening right away. He's looked like Trey Turner for the better part of four-plus months now, so that's exciting to see. We had a scare with Bryce Harper's elbow and that just kind of awkward collision at first base. No malintent whatsoever, but for a brief moment, I wondered if Harper had actually had a serious re-injury of the right elbow that he had Tommy John surgery on. So all of that wrapped into a back-and-forth exciting series that again, had tons of drama. And my first question for you about all of this, there was a moment where I think everybody inside Citizens Bank Ballpark thought that Ronald Acuna had hit a go-ahead home run. I wasn't at the stadium, of course, but seeing some of the reactions from the writers who were, they described the silence as the ball was in the air and how strange that was. It sounded like everybody in that park thought that Ronald Acuna Jr. had hit a go-ahead home run in the seventh inning until Johan Rojas caught that ball just in front of the wall.
Yeah, man. Like, talk about the importance of a couple plays on the warning track in this series. It was anytime you get Acuna up and in an opportunity like that to tie a game, to go ahead, whatever it may be, this is a guy who told you again and again all season that, like, I can come through in this situation. I can steal 70 bags. I can hit 40 homers. And for him to ultimately go rather quietly in this series was a surprise. But same goes for a number of Braves hitters. When you have a five-game series, it all comes down to how good is your starting pitching and who comes up clutch in that lineup. And they just didn't get quite enough of it. And so Acuna, off the bat, I thought it had a chance, and I think everybody else did until it nestled into the glove there.
The camera angle, too, also enhanced.
It's every time.
Definitely enhanced what looked like a home run that was going to land 20 feet behind the left center field wall. Now, the amazing thing to me in Game 4 was Ranger Suarez. Ranger yep. Suarez is one of those pitchers. There's a ton of guys that fit this sort of description. I see him as a mid-rotation guy that when you get to the playoffs, even knowing anything can happen, when you take somebody at this level, someone who's probably league-wide, just outside the top 50 among starting pitchers, if you ranked 150 starting pitchers, Ranger Suarez is somewhere in the 51 to 90 range. And there's a ton of debate that can happen there. I would never, never trust Ranger Suarez in a matchup against a lineup that was as good as the Braves were throughout the season. I was sure this game, this series was going to go to a game five. I was certain of it because the pitching matchup skewed so heavily in favor of Atlanta with Spencer Strider going, but that's why they play the games. And I think the other part of this is that over time, the Phillies have improved this bullpen to the point where at least the guys coming out have great stuff. Command consistently maybe lacking across this group, but it worked for them. They were able to bridge the gap from Ranger Suarez, who gave them five great innings of one run ball with five relievers to get those last 12 outs. And that was something that script-wise I had a hard time seeing going into game four.
We talked about this on deck before the series began, was how the Phillies are the hardest throwing bullpen out there. And we are not accustomed to a historical narrative that the Phillies bullpen is something close to shutdown. But here we are. These guys throw absolute gas. Even the new guy, Orion Kerkering, can come out and throw flames. And when you look at the situation last night, I was sure we were going to get a Ranger Suarez getting one turn through the rotation and then see if the bullpen can hold the fort down. And what he did was pretty incredible. If you look back at just the history he's had in the rotation, he really didn't crack into that rotation until 2021, had a really, really good season then. And then last year was really good as well, and basically a full season sample in that rotation. And this year, it felt like he took a step back. It was he's a guy who was hampered, I think, too much by command problems. 3.5 walks per nine innings is pretty standard for him across his big league career. And so he's a guy who is going to run into some traffic. And in the postseason, if you run into traffic and you have Ronald Acuna up or Austin Riley, one of these righties who can feast off of left-handers, you're more often than not going to end up with a little bit of a sideways number in one of these innings. And so for him to come out in these two starts he made in this series and go pitch into the fourth inning scoreless and pitch five innings, one run, and have only one walk across those two was such a huge part of this. And then only give up that one homer. This was Ranger at his best, because you walk into the postseason thinking there's a legitimate opening in that number three starter spot, right? Like it didn't seem like it was a sure thing. It would be Suarez. They had Wheeler, of course, and Nola in the first two spots, but then Christopher Sanchez would have been a fine option, I think, as that guy. Michael Lorenzen, they left off the roster, but he was an option. And then Tywin Walker, of course, is the other one. Good options to have, and they went with the lefty. Maybe to mix things up a little bit, and it paid off in a far better way than I even imagined.
Yeah, I did not see the script playing out the way that it did. Now, I think there's a lot of ways you can try and dissect what happened to Atlanta. Is it as simple as it's a five-game series? Anything can happen. Your greatness over 162 games does not matter, because if you take a very good team and a great team and they play five games, any combination of outcomes is possible. Like, do you think the calls for the postseason format to be rewritten again are largely from people who just don't understand variance and how math works? It's just the result of playing playoff baseball this way. It's so different than how you get seeding from the regular season.
I think there's a lot of just refusing to understand that, because it is, or maybe your team it happened to, and so you're upset. I mean, Jason Stark had a really good story about this morning, talking to winners and losers, he and Tyler Kepner, to see what they thought about it. And over on the Braves side, Spencer Strider, he totally owned it. He said, no, it's not the format thing. It's about executing. I didn't execute. I didn't do enough. And I know if you're a fan, you're going to be extremely upset about the way this has worked out, and you're looking for things to blame, but we can't be looking for excuses in the same way, because you look over across at what Houston has done. They are in their seventh consecutive championship series. They had layoffs. They had a weird September. They had all sorts of strange things happen, and yet they're back in the Final Four here. And so we see teams that are able to accomplish that. You can now put the Phillies in that same bucket of teams that are able to overcome whatever strangeness you have to go through in the postseason format. They've been a team that's faced one-game wild cards. They've faced three-game wild cards. And this time you had to face a three-game wildcard against the Marlins, who is upstart hot team, and beat them thoroughly, handily. And then you have to face the best team in baseball. And they did it, and they beat them in four games. And so there's got to be something to this October gene where you are just you're able to feed off whatever energy happens in that insane Philadelphia environment, and able to come through in that situation. There's some really good thoughts from JT Realmuto in that Stark piece. I encourage everyone to go read because it is a different ball game in October. And I think we can accept that and maybe even encourage that, that this season that could be a slog at times, it's gone in October. We have packed houses almost everywhere. And just this strategy is completely different in October. And the atmosphere, of course, is 180% different, 180 degrees different. And so I'm okay with that. I don't mind the variance. I think it's all right. Did I pick the Braves to win? Yeah, I did, because that's like where the smart money would be, the best team in baseball by a long shot this year. But ultimately, it comes down to who actually performs in a 5-game series. And is it going to be all that different to go 7 games in this series? I don't think so. You know, the Phillies probably could have taken one of those next 3 games. So I'm not really sweating it. Also, the Dodgers, if we want to throw them in here for a second, they had no pitching, and that's why they lost. It's very simple in their case. They had absolutely no pitching. They would have had to hammer the D-backs pitching with their own lineup, and they weren't able to do that. So that's why you're gone.
Yeah, so I think the people that blame the long layoff, right, for the teams that get that bye, Eno had a tweet that just went out last night after this series ended. The teams that have had longer layoffs are now 24-14 against their opponents. There's still a benefit to the rest. It's not the rest that's causing the bats to go cold. And we saw a lot of the key bats for the Braves run cold in this series. We saw Dodgers key bats run cold in that series against the Diamondbacks. That just happens. It's not a sign that the roster is broken. It's not a sign of tactical failure in some cases. You could also make arguments that come playoff time that the teams that are all there, maybe there's some that do outscout the other, or they have a game plan that they execute really well that works. It's possible. It's a potential endless chicken and egg debate. Did team A fail or did team B succeed? It's like, well, it could be a little bit of both, right? That's always a possibility. And I think when there's nuance to these conversations, people really struggle. I saw several tweets suggest that the regular season is pointless, and it's not. It's just a different format. The regular season is like running an ultra marathon. So all 30 teams are tasked with this 162-game season, and several teams run the ultra marathon really well. They get to the postseason. But then it's a series of like 5 and 10Ks to get through the playoffs. And you could be an ultra marathoner that's better than everybody else in the field, but when you go to the shorter races, you might not win, right? That's one analogy for it. But again, it comes back to just math and the way that a smaller sample of games can work. If you think the regular season is pointless, I should direct you to Premier League Soccer. There are no playoffs. It's 38 games. Most points wins. That's it. If you want baseball to be like that, I got bad news for you. It's not going to change. This is what we're going to get for the foreseeable future. And there is so much you can enjoy about it. It does sting if it's your team that gets bounced. But someday, your team will be the unexpected team to get through. Someday. Hopefully, you get to live to see it. Because it does take a while, if you're a smaller market team sometimes, to get back into the playoffs. Now, one other storyline around this Phillies team that I feel like is a little bit under discussed right now, Steven. This one comes from the baseball subreddit. There was a post that was just labeled, "Dave Dombrowski is a genius." I've heard a lot of praise for Phillies owner John Middleton for being willing to spend money. Obviously, a lot of credit to the players because they're the ones actually playing the games. But Dave Dombrowski, like, what he's done well to this point in his career has always been met with this criticism that, yeah, but when he leaves, the farm system is bad. And some of that's like that's very true, but some of that just looks right past the success. That the entire point of playing the game is to win a World Series. I see polls up every single day. Whose last 10 years would you rather have? The Red Sox with 2 World Series wins and some playoff misses, or the Dodgers with 1 World Series win and consistently making the playoffs every single year? And you can argue either side of that, but Dave Dombrowski has won in small markets, won back with the Marlins all the way back in the 90s. He's won with the Red Sox, and he's looking like he's got a team that's got a clear shot to do it again here in 2023 with these Phillies. So do you think Dave Dombrowski deserves more credit as someone who's had a lot of success in some very different places over his time in baseball?
I'm laughing because my last conversation with Dave was a couple months ago. I was writing about the 2003 Tigers, who famously lost 119 games, and he was the GM architect of that very, very sad team. So that was a lower moment. But even that team, you didn't mention the Tigers as a mid-big market. I mean, it's a big city.
They were spending a lot in that era. They certainly were. The Ilitch family at that time was spending a lot on payroll.
he was able to turn a 119 loss within 3 years into a World Series team that came up short, yes, and continued to come up short over the next several years. But he got the Tigers closer than anybody else have. And some of that is just convincing an owner to spend and convincing an owner to bring in stars. So we can joke all we want about how his whole game plan is to destroy the farm system and bring in at the expense of bringing in stars. But look, ownership wants to win a World Series. And if that's the mandate, then go do that. Now, is the mandate like the Angelos in Oriole land, where they're saying we're not going to spend a $200 million contract on anybody? We just can't afford that. Look at what we'd have to change in the whole revenue model to afford a $200 million player. And so, yeah, they're not going to, you know, they're not going to be able to operate the same way Dave Dombrowski will. And credit to him then for taking the advantages that his market or ownership provides him and running with it, because not everybody has that benefit. And so the goal is to, yes, be the goal for a lot of teams is to be a Rays, where you're a self-sustaining team. You don't pay anything at the major league level. You're doing it on the cheap. Or the goal for most clubs, I think, is let's be the Dodgers, who can be the self-sustaining organization, have all this talent in the pipeline. You trade away some prospects and still have a top 10 system, all while spending a bunch of money to keep Mookie Betts, to keep Freddie Freeman and all these other players. And so as we look at it now, the Phillies in Keith Law's preseason rankings were ranked 22nd in their farm system rankings. Not the worst. They're not 30th. There are teams in worse positions. And he's also locked up some of these guys long term. So had this series gone a different way, would you see an Alex Anthopoulos as a genius headline on this? Yeah, sure, because he's a genius in a totally different way, in that they've created this core and kept it together for forever, the foreseeable future, in a completely different way. They've done it by locking guys into long contracts early in their career. They're happy with the money they're making. They're happy with the stability, and they're going to make their careers in Atlanta. That's fantastic. But Dombrowski is taking what he has been given, taking the hand he's dealt, and he's played it to really the best of his abilities in now like five different cities. So you have to be pretty impressed with the Phillies roster and how it's performed. And then to see the sort of the glee with which these guys play. You see the quote that Bryce Harper had just the other day about how awesome Philly fans are. Like, talking about how he always wanted this environment. Well, you've helped create that by having winning baseball. That doesn't happen without winning baseball and, yes, a group of fans that are just total diehards.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I think there are people this morning who are sitting there saying, well, Atlanta has to make some big changes. They have to find ways to get around their October disappointments. And again, that overlooks the World Series title they just won a couple of years ago that somehow is forgotten already. And I think the other part of it is it's so easy right after the loss to forget how long this core is going to be together, right? Austin Riley got the big extension. He's there until 2032, at least 2032. Matt Olson's there until 29. They've got Raisel Iglesias still signed through 25, Acuna through 26 with options for 27 and 28. So he's there through 28. That's pretty safe to say at this point. Strider through at least 2028. Sean Murphy through at least 2028. Michael Harris through at least 2030. Albies through at least 25, but his club options, like Acuna's, are almost certain to be picked up. So that's really through 2027. That is an incredible core. That's the type of core you need to have in place to continue making runs at NL East titles, having first-round buys, but at least get into the postseason consistently. Like, if you're starting from there, even factoring in bad luck, injuries, things that can happen any of those given seasons, that is a great foundation to work with. Now, I think the big question is going to come back to what do they end up getting out of their current group of pitchers and how do they add to that group? Is it via trade? Is it spending in free agency? And I think that's the more complicated question. But when you look at how active and how aggressive they've been and how successful they've been in so many different facets of their organization, you should have a lot of confidence in their ability to address that problem to some degree.
They have given themselves a lot of flexibility with all these contracts too. When you have cost certainty, which owners love to have, even if it's 5-6 years, even better if it's that far down the road, if you can say we have our 2028 center fielder, you know how much our ownership loves that stuff? That's fantastic. And so, and also if we're keeping our ace through 2028, that's great, assuming Strider continues to pitch at this level, regardless of what's happened in the postseason lately. And so, yes, this is a team that's operated unlike any other in locking up this core. And when you talk about, you know, I think rightly criticize sometimes teams that overemphasize the, you know, bites at an apple type of analogy for the playoffs. Like all you need is a bite at the apple and you never know what's going to happen in the postseason, because that can lead to you bringing in a team like, let's say, the Marlins, who did not have enough firepower for the postseason against a team like the Phillies. And that's not to say that they shouldn't have done what they did. Like they're operating in a totally different way. But if your goal is to be the 2023 Marlins every year and just get a bite at the apple, well, good luck. Yeah, maybe one year you'll have that sort of Cinderella run. Anything can happen, right? The Rockies once won, what was it, 23, 24 or something ridiculous. Like, yes, good to, you know, mediocre to good teams can sometimes do amazing things. But what you need to do is have, the other thing, the 54% thing, I don't know if you missed it while you were out. You can talk like that. You can talk about bites at the apple. But what the Braves are doing is they're giving themselves a bite at the apple every year with a team that can actually win the World Series without squinting, right? You don't need to do any, if you know, Strider pitches well, they don't really have a number two. But no, this is a team that legitimately can look at them and say, what went wrong this year? You know, the starting pitching wasn't as good as it could have been. The offense went a little quiet in an important series. They just couldn't quite catch up. And they caught like the hottest team in baseball right now. The Phillies are just operating on another level. They got great starting pitching. They got lineup that did crazy things. Nick Castellanos just hit 4 bombs in 2 games. Like that doesn't happen every series, but it did. And so you got the wrong end of it. And you weren't able to come up with that series, but also you didn't have Charlie Morton, right? So you're going with Bryce Elder in game 3. Things could have gone a little bit better. Some of your relievers could have been healthier, whatever. And so the Braves still are putting themselves in a position to be back next year as a World Series contender, win 100 plus games, you know, if they're, I think they're still positioned to do that. And that's great. So yeah, it is all about the bites of the apple. You need to get in the dance to win the thing. But if you can get in the dance every year and be in a position like the Dodgers, like the Braves, like the Astros are, that you can legitimately be looked at as a World Series favorite or contender, then that's what you have to be doing. The goal is not to be sneaking into the playoffs, and they've set themselves up for a long time of being in the conversation as the World Series favorite.
I imagine it's exhausting to run the full season, play as well as you do, and have it end so abruptly from a player perspective, knowing how good you are, knowing that the window, while it's open for a long time, it can close faster than you expect. I think players have a pretty good sense for that. And just thinking about going through it again next year, like you need time to decompress before you can go into that and have, I think, the clear, like, proper mindset for it. As far as the Astros go, let's shift the focus over to the ALCS for a bit. That's going to get underway on Sunday. Astros-Rangers. And it seems impossible, but the Astros are in the American League Championship Series for the 7th consecutive year. I know this is a franchise that, because of trash cans, that is largely just hated around the league. There's other reasons, but that's the main one that I think the typical baseball fan outside of Houston doesn't like this Astros team. This is why they're a modern villain in baseball. That level of success is remarkable. They've had plenty of players they've lost along the way who are part of that core, guys like Correa and Springer. They have found ways to replace them. They have found pitching and developed pitching that didn't always come with the big prospect pedigree. They have been willing to go out and make trades, and they brought back Justin Verlander a second time. So there's a lot to like about this organization. I wonder if this is the later part of their window. I think it's fair to ask those questions. There's been changes in that front office on multiple occasions now. When you look at their minor league system as it's currently built, it's harder to see 3, 4, 5 years from now the same sort of success. But the run they're having, if they're able to get another World Series before this window closes, I think as time passes, especially, the respect for what they've accomplished will grow. Now, thinking back to this regular season, the Astros went 9-4 against the Rangers in the regular season. You and I both know that actually doesn't matter because it's a clean slate. It's a best of seven series. Rangers are on fire right now, playing extremely well, hitting everything. And I think the thing that maybe gets lost in the conversation between these two teams, Levi Weaver did a great job pointing this out in the windup this week. This is a nasty rivalry. These teams hate each other. And I think we're all about to get a really good glimpse of just how deep this rivalry actually runs when we see these teams square off in the ALCS.
Yeah. What is it? Was it the Golden Boot series? Or no, that's not the Golden Boot. I'll figure it out. But yeah, this is going back quite a ways, right? I mean, this is, you go all the way back to the beginning. This is the Astros were an expansion team. The Rangers were a few years behind them as a relocation, the Washington Senators. There's a lot of history. They were in the opposite league, and then all of a sudden they weren't. They're in the same division right next door to each other. These cities have obviously a huge rivalry, not being far from each other, intrastate. But yeah, the teams, you know, Jeff Banister had a big moment with them. We saw earlier this season with Adolis Garcia and Martin Maldonado, I think, having a moment together. Yeah, this is going to be electric. It's going to be, I feel like it's going to be a bit like Phillies Braves in the intensity that we just saw, which is great. Line them up, because I don't think that Phillies D-backs has like a ton of history, if I'm not mistaken.
They can't. I mean, it's just the part of it's the Diamondbacks haven't existed long enough, haven't been in the postseason long enough. They play at opposite sides of the country. They don't see each other that much. So yeah, not enough bad blood there.
There will be intensity because it's for a chance to go to the World Series. I don't think it's going to be bad blood. So we needed that. So I guess this is why we scripted it this way. But you're right. The Astros have put themselves in a position, winning seven of these in a row. I was just looking up Justin Verlander's stat page, which if you want to just go gawk for a little while at something. This guy, despite having like a mid-career significant lull, is pitching in his ninth CS, all of them ALCS. And this guy's gone to the World Series six times, I think it is, if I counted right. Absurd what he's done, but also absurd in a tip of your cap way for the Astros to go back and get him this year, to decide like, yo, we can't pay a 40-year-old what the Mets are about to pay him, let them do their thing, and then midsummer realize, listen, our rotation is not as dominant as we thought it was. We had an injury. We had Urquidy not being as good as we were hoping he'd be. We had Christian Javier taking a slight step back in some ways, although some of the peripherals are still like, this guy is going to be incredible. And of course, we saw what he did last postseason, combined no-hitter in the World Series. And we've got Framber Valdez, who's an ace. But we have an opportunity here to give up Ryan Clifford, who's going to be really good, and Drew Gilbert, who we think is going to be good, to get Justin Verlander back for 2 years and pay him only like a pretty absurd rate, because the Mets are willing to cover a large portion of all that. As we talked about, like a Dombrowski type of move. That is we have a chance to win a World Series and make ourselves among the favorites, certainly in the American League. Let's go do it. Let's do what it takes, and we'll figure out the prospect thing later. Because you're right, the window won't last forever. It never does. But if you deem Justin Verlander good enough to go pitch your game one in the CS, then you make that move every time, and the Astros are willing to do it. So, you know, people will criticize them for generations about banging trash cans, but they have built a bit of a Death Star here in the AL, and everyone is trying to catch up. And the Rangers could be the team that does it right now, because they have been building by spending gobs of money on players, and that's one way to do it. Good for them. And then having guys like Evan Carter break through and immediately have a huge impact. We can get more into him later. The impact he's had in every facet of the game. But this is going to be awesome. If there was one series I was keyed in on, it was Philadelphia against Atlanta. And this one, if I had to only pick one of these to watch, it's certainly going to be the Texas series.
Yeah, and I don't think that's intended to take anything away from what should also be a great series between the Phillies and Diamondbacks. Diamondbacks are a fun team. I think the questions I have about Arizona are actually somewhat similar to the questions I have about the Rangers. I wonder how the pitching holds up for both of these teams. There's a lot of injuries that could actually lead to some guys coming back for the Rangers because of this timetable. We could see John Gray back. We could see Max Scherzer back in this series. That goes a long way. Nathan Eovaldi has been fantastic. I think what's interesting about the Rangers is because of their spending, their willingness to add at the deadline and add a ton in free agency the last two off seasons. This is more of a Philadelphia type build, but they tacked it onto what was a really good group of players in their minor league system. So they are going to have some veterans over the next several years that should mostly age gracefully. I think guys like Corey Seager and Marcus Semien, I think, are going to age really well because of the types of hitters that they are. And whether they sustain a five-year window versus like a three-year window is probably going to come back to how well they develop some of the young guys. Evan Carter is just one example of a top-level prospect that they've been able to bring up. Josh Jung, finally healthy for a full season this year, is an impact guy for sure. You know, there's just a lot to like about this roster. My biggest concern is what happens in the games when the starting pitching doesn't give them at least five innings. That's where I think the Rangers could be vulnerable. The good news for Rangers fans, I think this lineup is capable of hitting just about anybody the Astros throw out there. So this could be just an absolutely wild series from a run production perspective. And yeah, I think that's pretty fun. If you're a neutral observer, you love that. If you're a fan of one of these teams, you're probably sweating every single inning throughout the entire series.
And to those of you who are screaming into your headphones, that is not the golden boot. That's a soccer term. Silver boot series. The silver boot series. I'm sorry. Apologies, guys. I know that one goes back a long way. But I think you're exactly right. The Rangers, the X factor here is the Rangers rotation. If they can get what they've gotten from Jordan Montgomery, which we've all had our laughs about the Yankees trading away a guy who wasn't a big game playoff guy and then him turning into exactly that for the Rangers two franchises later. And Nathan Eovaldi to do what he's done. He's had such a good postseason resume. That number three spot's so up in the air, right? Is Heaney, Dunning, all that. Well, if you can slot Max Scherzer in there at 80%, 85% and talk him into throwing two turns to the rotation, or if you get John Gray and either of those guys are fully healthy, well, suddenly you can get really creative. You can get in, you know, do some really interesting things here. And they have options now if those two guys are healthy and or close to it. And I don't know if that means Scherzer coming out of the bullpen to gas it up for two innings. Probably not. Probably not the smartest thing to do when you've got a lot of money invested in this guy. And the Mets also have a lot of money invested in this guy. Come on, you got to think about the Mets investments right now all over these playoffs. But I don't – this the bullpen, as good as they have been so far, you just don't feel – you don't feel good about it if you're burning half that bullpen in one game to cover up for a two-inning start, right? For a, you know, if John Gray goes short, or if Andrew Heaney has to go and only gives you one turn through the rotation or through the lineup, that's a tough sell. So that's what I worry. We had to do our staff picks for the series, and we got to do our staff picks for the series, and I picked
had to.
I picked the Astros because I think both of these lineups can make lives miserable for the other pitching staffs. And if one of these staffs is going to crack, I think it's the Rangers. I mean, the odds are like double the Astros being the ones to really falter. Although it's certainly possible. But if let's say game one or game two, Montgomery or Eovaldi get beat, that already, I think, puts the Rangers back on their heels where they need, okay, we need an outing now from Heaney or a mostly healthy Scherzer or something like that. And if you get down, you know, 2-1 or something, you're back to starting to feel like they're against the wall against this type of team. So that rotation, I think they need big outings again from Montgomery and Eovaldi, as unfair as that is to say, because they've been so good so far.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's sort of a signature of the Astros in recent years is the combination of the ability to do damage, but to do it without having a high strikeout rate. Right, we have a lot of players in this league now who can sustain great barrel rates and pop 25 or 30 home runs, and they do it with a lot of swing and miss. It comes with a high 20, maybe even a low 30% K rate. And yet again, as a team, the Astros have a top five offense, but they have a K rate under 20% as a group. And I think one of the things that separates you as an offense in October is putting pressure on the opposing team by putting more balls in play. Anything can happen when you put the ball in play. And I think that's part of why, you know, a team like the Twins, like the, think of their lineup and the damage they can do, which is legit, but the downside comes from when they start swinging and missing, the offense gets really cold really fast. That's what I think makes Houston so dangerous. And they have, I mean, Yordan Alvarez. Steven, if you said, who in the league is capable of matching a season like the one that Aaron Judge had a year ago? Yordan Alvarez is my answer to that, as far as the power and just the absolute just dominance. The approach is so good. I think the only hesitation some people have about Alvarez and making a prediction or a projection like that comes back to the health of his legs. Fortunately, his legs have been healthy ever since the surgeries. The concerns have been, you know, pushed further and further away. But I think that's the main thing for me with Houston. They're very close. The Rangers offense by WRC plus fourth in the league. Astros were fifth. Overall pitching, I always look at K minus BB percentage for a staff, and I realize you can cherry pick and only use your better pitchers in October, so you don't necessarily get dragged down by your worst players. Houston 15.1%, Rangers 14.3%. That's the 13th and 17th best team. They're very similar in that regard. But I think the separating factor, aside from the swing and miss and the lineup being a little less with Houston, comes back to the number of relievers that I trust when the game is on the line. That number is much greater in the Houston bullpen than it is in the Texas bullpen. As we've learned from the Diamondbacks throughout this postseason, my trust level in a bullpen doesn't matter because your wobbly relievers can right the ship at just the right time. They can execute, they can locate, they can get lucky. Like, all of those things can happen. So those would be my reasons for leaning Astros, but I think it's going to be a great series. This one could easily go seven.
The point I wanted to make about what you said about the Astros and they're going with guys with low K rate or having a overall put the ball in play mentality is they're able to do that to such an extent that they can stomach having Martin Maldonado in that, which the pitchers love. Everyone will tell you up and down how good he is for that staff, how good he is for that team. He is a bad hitter, bad. And he has a 34% strikeout rate. And so if you're running a guy out there who's below the Mendoza line, doesn't get on base, cannot slug for the life of him, and he strikes out all the time, you're running, this is not totally fair to him, but it's like kind of like you're running the old school NL days with a pitcher in your lineup. But they're able to do with the other eight hitters pretty outrageous things. And they have Yainer Diaz on the bench if, you know, he wants to slug a homer for them in the DH role or in a catcher role. They have that. And so it's pretty impressive what they're able to do with that lineup, with especially the top five in that lineup. And then if you toss in Jose Abreu, who's usually been their five, has really come on lately, come on strong. And, you know, Michael Brantley to be your on-base guy. They have sort of a little bit of every type of hitter, except it feels like the guy who just is all or nothing, strikeout or homer type of guy. So the answer, though, to your question, who can pull off the Judge season, though, it's Nick Castellanos, no doubt.
If the entire season gets played in October, maybe.
And then Yordan Alvarez second.
Yeah, you look at the body of work from the regular season. Alvarez, Altuve, Kyle Tucker, Chaz McCormick, and Yainer Diaz, along with Alex Bregman, six players that were in this lineup had WRC pluses of 125 or better. It is really hard to navigate a lineup where six players are 25% better than league average. And, you know, McCormick's a perfect example of guy that has exceeded expectations, whether that's, you know, the combination of his own hard work, player development, scouting to get him in the organization in the first place. Part of what has made the Astros successful is not just having those superstars that have stuck around, but finding guys like McCormick and last year especially Jeremy Pena, guys who have been able to come up and fill those roles effectively when the likes of Springer and Correa have left in free agency. I also think it's interesting when a team gets really lucky with a mistake. I think Jose Abreu has proven to be a mistake. At the time they signed him, I didn't believe that. I thought it was actually an okay signing because of the quality of the contact he makes, the track record he'd put together. I thought he'd age more gracefully. He's shown up in a few key spots this postseason. I still think that's a little bit of a wild card. That could be a slightly easier matchup for the Rangers to navigate. It's like, don't let Jose Abreu hurt you. That's actually pretty tough he's a guy that's been through it a few times, and I think that's part of what makes this team so dangerous too. Other than Maldonado, there's no easy path there. And even Maldonado at least occasionally runs into a homer.
Yeah.
If you can just occasionally take a hack and drive one out of the yard, that's worth something.
Yeah, I shouldn't have degraded his slug so much. He's got some. The other thing I want to point out with this lineup is one thing I really like to look at. I don't know if you do this, but hey, everybody, go to Savant, Baseball Savant, and look up pitch arsenal stats. I love to see what guys are dominant against certain pitches. And over the whole league, the top three players against fastballs this year by run value, Matt Olson at 24 run value, Kyle Tucker and Chaz McCormick at 22nd. So I love to look at that going into a series. Nick Castellanos also great against the fastball, which you saw him turn on 100 miles an hour last night. Pretty good. And so that's something that I like to check out for a series. See what sort of matchups you have coming up. For instance, Jordan Montgomery doesn't throw a ton of fastballs. And so maybe that's a good matchup for the Rangers against a team that will crush some fastballs. And that's one of my favorite ones, because McCormick, you would never guess that this guy's third in baseball or tied for second in baseball against fastballs this season, and the run value against fastballs. That's pretty pretty special. And even if you sort this by like run value per 100 pitches, so it's not so much like a cumulative thing, the player in baseball with at least 50 plate appearances this year with the most value against a certain pitch per 100, Yordan Alvarez in the changeup. Do not throw this man a changeup. It is not going to tail away far enough, and you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be chasing that ball down in the right field bleachers.
I think from a game planning perspective, trying to get Yordan Alvarez out, I mean, trying to get any of the elite hitters out, even when you got guys with great stuff, that is an incredibly difficult problem. There's just some guys you can't really pitch to. So you try your best to pitch around them. You try to come up with something they haven't seen before. One of the things that I thought was interesting about the Astros twin series, and I don't know if Eno mentioned it on 3-0 yesterday, but I think he was tweeting about it at least, was the Astros seemingly looking for Sonny Gray's sweeper, sort of having a game plan of hunting that pitch, the most effective pitch in a deep arsenal. And my thought was, if you did something like that against the guy that, at least Savant says he's got six different pitches, if you hunt one thing like that, that might lead to some other problems. It obviously didn't in that particular case. There might be a lot of value in taking away the opposing starting pitcher's best weapon, right? And clearly the Astros have some guys that can destroy fastballs, but if they can also take your best breaking pitch away, that's a problem. Because a lot of guys don't have as much stuff to turn to as Sonny Gray does, and it still didn't work out for Gray in that matchup.
Yeah, I was going to say another one of these guys who rates extremely well in run value per 100 pitches is Corey Seager against the curveball. And it's funny because you like think about this, and even in this, like my mental Rolodex, I can see him smashing a curveball. Like I can see countless homers like, oh yeah, kind of left that one hanging a little bit over the plate and he smacked it in the right field seats. Yeah, that tracks. You know who's got a great curveball? Justin Verlander. And so maybe he shies away from that and goes slider instead. Maybe he tries to ride the four seam high on Corey Seager. So if you start to look into that stuff and play around with it a bit, I think you start to see almost a cool preview for what you're about to see on the field, because yeah, Verlander doesn't want to, you know, mess around and hit a hot zone with his curveball against Corey Seager.
I'm not going to have a full explanation of why, because I don't think the why always matters when it comes to postseason baseball, even though I think the Astros have more to like on paper. I think I'll say it goes seven. I think the Rangers find a way to get it done. And it's just one of those amazing October series that we talk about for a long time. I guess it's just what I'm hoping for, just for something different. But it would not surprise me if the Astros do what the Astros do, because there's such a well-constructed team for all the reasons that we've talked about.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision.
Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary nano experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
Some other news to get to here before we go, Steven. You and I were watching a little video yesterday. Rintaro Sasaki, if you've been following baseball news this week, you may have heard. He's the Japanese Prince Fielder, at least by nickname at this point. We had a news story on The Athletic. Melissa Lockard put that together. Sasaki, 6 feet tall, 250 pounds. He is a high school player coming out of Japan. He hit 140 home runs in high school, which is a new record in Japan. And he is going to come and play college ball in the U.S. instead of going pro and playing an NPB in Japan, which for a prospect of this caliber is really unprecedented. So there's a lot to unpack here. I mean, a 6 foot tall, 250 pound high school kid that crushes the ball is an exciting prospect for sure. I think it was ESPN's Kylie McDaniel had a write up and pointed to 70 grade raw power right now. It's 30 home run power in the big leagues. And I was like, that's okay. That's real power. That's what we're looking for. How do you project a player like this with that incredible raw power, record breaking results, a very large player for age 17 especially, and someone who has questions about where he's going to fit defensively too? I mean, the good news is we get more time to see him before major league teams will, you know, spend some seemingly high draft pick on him. But what do you make of Rintaro Sasaki digging in a little bit this week and trying to get a sense for what he might bring to the table in the long run? Because all of this gives him a much faster path to eventually play in the big leagues.
Yeah, My initial take was, well, thank goodness we're going to get probably 3 years of him playing likely SEC ball. The report so far at Vanderbilt is most likely landing spot. Makes sense. They are a powerhouse. They know what they're doing as far as pro development. So it's going to be really interesting to see, because there are guys, you know, in every country who've tried to play baseball who can hit homers, who have huge power and then strike out all the time. We just mentioned those type of players. And is that type of player going to be real valuable in Major League Baseball? No, not really. You can probably find a way to live. I covered Pedro Alvarez in Pittsburgh. It ended up all being all he could do, and he ended up flaming out a bit after a decent, nice start to his career. Couldn't really play third base and moved over to first eventually. So yes, there are ways for this to go poorly. At the same time, he's 17 years old. There's all kinds of reasons to be excited for what he can do. This is not a guy playing terrible competition. This is a guy who went to Shohei Ohtani's high school. This is a guy whose dad is Shohei Ohtani's high school manager. Hiroshi Sasaki was the father who coached Ohtani. I believe this is where Yusei Kikuchi also went to high school. I may have been missing one other name. Anyway, this is a baseball factory in Japan, that they know what they're doing. This is not some flash in the pan kid. This is someone who's been really, really well known there and was expected to be the number one pick in the NPB draft and instead has decided to not put his name in and come to the U.S. So this is exciting. It's for college ball, right? This is feels like a moment with like college hockey where you get, yes, I used to cover college hockey, where you get, you know, a guy who's going to get drafted in the OHL draft or something and play in Canada, instead decides to go college hockey route because there's something he's wanting there. And in this case, what does Sasaki likely want? Probably a faster route to Major League Baseball, right? You saw, if I'm not speaking out of turn here, Ohtani didn't play the requisite number of years to be able to be a free agent with a posting fee and all that, or with a posting fee. He had to go through the international signing process. And so teams were limited in how much they could offer. Everyone could basically offer around the same amount of money that wasn't going to be anything near what he's worth as a starting pitcher and a DH. And Sasaki is able to go now through a process where he goes to play college ball for 3 years. I think Kylie McDaniel reported, maybe somebody else, that I think he's not going to be able to start this coming year. It'll be in 2025, I think he starts. So 2027, I think, is when he would be eligible for the draft. Or spring of 25, I think, would be his first season. And then spring of 27 would be his junior year, and he'd be able to be drafted after that. So there are a lot of interesting things to follow here. But bottom line, how do you grade a guy like this? We're gonna need some more reps, because what we're looking at right now is YouTube footage, pretty good YouTube footage for high school in Japan. But he looks like a first baseman, right? Mm-hmm. He's a big kid. He's at 6 feet, 250 pounds right now. We don't know how his body's gonna project over these. There's a lot of physical maturity that needs to happen. He could muscle up, he could thin out, he could fit at third base eventually, right? We talked about Mike Moustakas didn't look like a third baseman, but he had a great glove. So I don't know if Sasaki's got a plus glove, a plus arm right now. That's all going to factor in. Could he wind up in first base and it'd be great? Yeah, like the Prince Fielder comp? Sure, that could work. Every team's going to love to have defensive versatility, so that's going to be something they look at as he gets more experience, and we'll see what happens at potentially Vanderbilt. But it's not out of the question that he could possibly go to another position. And that's all just going to depend, I think, more on the what the glove and the arm tool looks like than what his size looks like right now. You know, a lot of us look different at 17 than we did at 21, at 22, whatever. And so, or even at 20, I guess, 21 probably when he would be drafted. So the good news, we're going to see him do this probably in SEC play for a few years. We're not going to have to guess like we do for Japanese players, for Korean players when they're coming over, of like, okay, what level of competition was he seeing? You know, how good was the level of competition? Is he facing 80 mile an hour fastball, or like, you know, mid 80s, or is he facing high velocity? You know, he can get around on that 85 at the letters and crank it for a homer. Some of these homers, go watch them. Like, first off, a ridiculous number of homers, but the way he's hitting them, it's just like he's hitting them from his, you know, from the ankles, from up at the letters. He's a big lefty, and he's got incredible power, and he's hitting them at pro stadiums too. So it's cool to watch. But can he catch up to that, you know, 95 up at the letters? And we're gonna get a chance to see him play college ball in a way that you can go see him every single time he plays if you want. It's not a big trip over to Japan every time you want to see him play. And we'll get him on ESPN and some of these other you know, channels every once in a while. So they're going to have a very good read on this kid by the time he actually gets to be draft ready. And then that's, I think, the real blessing of all this, of him coming over selfishly for us as media and as teams, is they get a chance to see him a lot.
Yeah, I wonder if you ask front offices, you know, what would you rather have, half decade of professional numbers from Japan or 3 years in the SEC as far as getting a read on what you think a player is going to do? I'm curious to what side of that they'd actually be on. We've had enough players come over from Japan, or both are modeled. Both of those things are problems they have to solve. But if they actually had a choice from this starting point, what tells you more about Rintaro Sasaki? I don't know. I'd like to know where that lands.
It's a good question, but you're also just talking about completely different players at that point, because you're talking about, are you going to be able to get acquire a player at 21, having 3 years of SEC play, or having, you know, 5 to 8 years in Japan when he would be in his mid 20s or later? And so I think every team would say, well, I'll take the known quantity of a couple of years of college play. We saw him play a ton, drafted him where he liked him, and now we get to have our hands on him and develop him exactly the way we want, rather than have him get into the middle of his career. He is the hitter he's going to be because he's trained that way, he's developed that way, and it's going to be much harder to have any hand in you know, or any impact really on altering his development. Where if you get him at 21, you still have a chance to do that as you bring him to the minor league. So I think, I'm guessing they all would pick that, but the question as to like the level of play and how consistent it would be a really interesting one, and we can throw that at Keith next time.
Yeah, absolutely. Other baseball news coming out of Japan, if you track these types of things, there's a lefty reliever, Yuki Matsui, who's going to exercise his international free agency rights. He'll pursue an MLB contract this winter. So Matsui will be someone we could probably see in a major league bullpen next season, for all of next season. Over 200 saves. He's actually 27 years old, became the youngest player in NPB history to reach 200 saves. You know, watching what he was doing on video, I think the biggest question is going to be velocity. Is this velocity going to be enough for him to maintain numbers anywhere near the 36.4% K rate he's posted over the last three seasons in Japan?
Yeah, his numbers are fantastic and have been only getting better in the last 3 years as he has noticed his K rate down, or sorry, his walk rate down. It was 4.4 per nine innings in 2021, which is a little concerning. 3.3 last year, and just a flat two this year. So that's fantastic. If you pair that with an 11.7 percent strikeout rate, which he's had over his NPB career, which is long at this point. That's great. This guy doesn't let a lot of traffic on. He gets a lot of strikeouts. But how is that going to play in the majors? I was seeing reports that he's in like the 91 to 93 range with his fastball. Coming from the left side, you could have some deception. You could have all sorts of different arm angle stuff. It didn't look like anything too crazy as far as angle as we were seeing on TV. But what he has that's worked so effectively is his off-speed stuff. He's got a forkball. He's got a slider. And those are great out pitches. I was watching what appears to be his last out in NPB was striking out the someone tweeted this. I'm sorry, I don't have their name in front of me, but the Coco home run champion of this season, Gregory Polanco, who I know well for his days in Pittsburgh. He struck him out to end his likely end his NPB career for Matsui. And so it can play. Is it closer stuff in Major League Baseball? I don't know. We don't really have a comp for that right now. We don't have a 5'8 lefty throwing low 90s with great breaking stuff to compare him to. And so I think there's certainly going to be value here. I saw a report, I think it was Yahoo Japan who threw this out there, that the likely number he would be hitting was 4 years and $32 million. And so it's not a huge investment, but it's not nothing. And so I think teams are just going to want to see him pitch. So I'm sure they've done their work on him. I know for a fact the Red Sox have done that. I saw Yahoo Japan say the Yankees, the Cubs are among other teams that did it. The Padres also visited in October. So they're going to want to get their eyes on him. How does it play against major leaguers? This is all modeled. They can check all this stuff and the movement he has. But the bottom line is, if he is a guy who does not walk and he can maintain some of these strikeout rates, even if the strikeout rates get shaved a little bit from what he was doing in Japan, he has the potential to be a very valuable pitcher, even if I don't necessarily think he's going to get thrown right away into a closer role with that arsenal. It might just work. We just haven't seen anybody like this very recently.
Yeah, late innings seem likely. The closer role seems like a little bit of a stretch, but we'll see. We'll see once we get some more information on Matsui if he can actually take on a role like that.
And listen, all credit and respect to Gregory Polanco, great guy, but striking him out with a breaking ball to end a game doesn't surprise me all that much. And so, yeah, we'll have to see how that's going to play against guys currently in the major leagues.
I thought Gregory Polanco was going to be really, really good. El Coffee. Oh, I was so excited about the nickname. I love coffee, so I think that made me really like want Gregory Polanco to be good.
Greg Polanco, easy guy to root for. I once met up with him in Dominican Republic to run through a workout with him at the side of a road right by like a botanical gardens. He was totally game. He was great, extremely friendly, but things just didn't work out. And there's a crucial injury that hurt his career, sliding into second base horribly, and hurt his shoulder. So things have not worked out. Things have gone pretty well over in Japan, but he never could hit the breaking ball very well. That's the point. Against lefties especially.
I am going to check eBay and see if I can find a Gregory Polanco Pirates jersey for an affordable price, because the weekend is here. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, or now it's known as X, you can find Steven at Steven J. Nesbitt. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. Subscribe to the YouTube channel if you haven't done so already for The Athletic Baseball Show. We appreciate everybody who's done that. That is going to do it for this episode of The Athletic Baseball Show. We're back with you next week.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.